Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, comrades. This is not going to be a happy episode today. I had an interview with the president of our Chamber of Industry and Commerce, who also runs the largest private university in the Baltics, Turiba. But, you know, I promised that I would be touching modern news and current events as they happen, if something interesting happened, And sadly, there is a certain interesting event that took place that we found about on August the 1st. It presumably happened a bit before. There were three dead, my colleagues, essentially. Orhan Cemal, Alexander Rostorguyev, and Kirill Radchenko. These three journalists were murdered in the Central African Republic. And I kind of, you know, think about it as my duty to give them some tribute and to give some clearance and analysis on what's going on, about what they were doing there, what really happened, and what the current theories are. Because the more I looked at all this mess, the more I understood that what's happening just doesn't make any sense. And that this is a huge tragedy to all journalism as such. These guys were professional war correspondents and experienced professionals, really. Orhan Cemal was 51 at the time, and he's been a war correspondent for over 25 years. He's very famous in Russia and in like all of Eastern Europe for his participation in being this war correspondent since forever, basically. He was there in Georgia, in the Russian-Georgian War. He was in Donbass, obviously. He was in Syria, Libya. He was shot in Libya and survived. He's been in all the hotspots on planet Earth, basically. So he knew what he was doing there, really. But apparently, yeah, and Mr. Rostorguyev, he's one of the biggest names. He was one of the biggest names in Russian documentary movie circles. He was a great director and had won many awards. And Radchenko, who was 33, Radchenko was one of those people who worked as a cameraman, who just, you know, always was there with Rostorguyev and was... Well, these guys are those who filmed basically for opposition news media. They filmed, like, protest actions in Russia. They always knew what was going on. And Orhan Cemal, he was truly, you know, he loved war. And it's a weird thing to say, but in one of his last interviews that I watched, because he spoke a lot about what was going on in Russia, and he was one of the biggest Putin's critics as well, he wrote a book about the Georgian War and about, like, Ossetia and everything, and Chechnya too. And one of his statements was that he had basically fallen in love with war, in the same way as professional soldiers often do, having difficulty getting back in civilian life. He said that war is freedom, in a way, for him, because that that human experience that you get in these zones, it's weird. And he's also important because I had communicated with him a bit, and I wanted to get him on the show because he said that his duty as a war correspondent stemmed from the fact that it's why people love history, and he told Echo Moskvy in that interview that he just likes being there where history is made now, and he likes to report on the very bare bones humans, because the war tears everything away. He likes to get these real emotions from people, and he likes to be there when history is made. And he certainly was a professional. Also, yeah, in his criticisms against Putin, Jamal often spoke, because yeah, I know most of these three people, I know most about Jamal, but for some, Rastorguyev is more famous. Jamal always spoke that there, you know, that there really can't be any reforms in Russian Federation, that it's going to end up violently, and he presented a lot of the arguments that I've given you over these past few years about what I think is going to happen in Russia. But so these three men, they arrived in the Central African Republic to investigate the activities of the private warfare company Wagner. Hey, those nice mercs, we've mentioned them before. And this was kind of big, because as I dug deeper into this whole situation, I understood that it was a bit different and a bit deeper than I thought before. So yeah, I apologize for this emotional introduction for this episode, but, you know, when journalists get killed, for me as a representative of this profession, it's always sad, and it's never nice to you know, speak about deaths of what I consider to be great professionals, even if I didn't always agree with what they had to say. So this episode is dedicated to these guys, to the men who loved war, and who perished by it, obviously. And I'm going to take a look about what happened, why it happened, and all the theories that are going around about who did it and why. And usually this would be the point where in my intro I say, well, sit back and enjoy, but this one's not for enjoying. This one's for understanding, I suppose, and thinking a bit. Anyhow, here we go. So, what actually happened? Alexander Rastorguyev, Orhan Jamal, and Kirill Radchenko arrived in the Central African Republic, CAR for short, I'm going to use that onwards, in the 27th of July. This is told us by their partners and financiers from Center for Control of Investigations. This center is a center of independent journalistic investigations, which is funded by, well, for the most part, by famous Russian businessman Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Yeah, he also of the past episode fame. And basically, the guys were hired and sent there, financed, all this was financed by Khodorkovsky, who was now, by the way, funding his own investigation into the matters. But so, to take an investigative, make investigative footage, make a film about the Russian instructors from the private warfare company Wagner there. Russians are in Central African Republic. They numbered about 170, approximately, and they're there officially. They serve as instructors, but I presume by this point you could put instructors in quotation marks, and personal guards for the president of the CAR, because they're although CAR is a majority Christian country, they have an aggressive Muslim separatist group, Selenko, at least that's how the Russian media call it, and I won't bother to Google up a precise term, just called Selenko or Selenko, whatever. This investigation was a kind of their collaborative project. And by the point they actually left for the Central African Republic, that investigation had been going on for a few months now. And in a few interviews, Orhan Jamal had already stated that he feels like he's being followed in his home. And so that no one could mess up their investigation, these three journalists, this group, didn't know about their going neither to the local powers, nor to the Russian embassy, nor to the Russian government, nothing. They went there on tourist visas without proper governmental accreditation. But then again, you know, if you go investigate Putin's best friends and this Prigozhin's private warfare company, Wagner, again, who are basically there to get riches out of everything, then, yeah, it wouldn't make sense for them to actually try to register this, especially as they're working together with Khodorkovsky. The center, this is the center of the control of investigations. In Russian, it makes more sense, but yeah. Center, this has given us a lot of information about this in their own press releases, both in their Telegram channel, which I read, and in YouTube. And Center basically stated that they only asked for aid to one of these to one of the members of the peacekeeping forces there, the United Nations peacekeeping forces, and he was apparently named Martin, and they don't know his surname. Then I quote here, straight from their Telegram channel. The issues of safety were among the most prioritized ones. They communicated with a United Nations operative, and also they discussed the more safer routes to where they needed to go. But yeah, about these peacekeepers. The United Nations peacekeepers were entering, and they're there in the Central African Republic starting with 2014 to basically stop a civil war that's been going on there for about a decade or more. And although they haven't stopped violence completely, they now control most of the territory of CAR. The press secretary of the mission, this United Nations peacekeeping mission, Vladimir Monteiro, in the 1st August, basically stated that these journalists hadn't informed the United Nations about their arrival, and that the organization itself, the peacekeeping forces there, they don't do, like, accreditation of journalists or anything in a special way. And again, like the people in the center state that before arrival, person, apparently, who claimed to be their contact there, this Martin, again, who claimed to be from the United Nations peacekeeping forces there, he kind of went for contacts, and he was, like, they were able to get in touch with him, like, approximately once every 2 days. Well, as of August the 1st, which was about a day after the murder of the journalists, this whole center hadn't contacted him at all. And it wasn't even clear, was he even informed about the fact that the journalists won't arrive to meet him at all. Then, currently, it's just unknown about this Martin guy, he's just vanished. The chief editor of the center, Andrei Konyakhin, basically stated that he can't talk about this because he's basically now helping the families of the dead. And yeah, they also just can't contact Martin. By the way, technically Martin exists. He's apparently registered as part of the French group there, but he's a very shady character, essentially. But yeah, Martin apparently had been the guy who had recruited their driver, their local driver there, and the local journalist on the spot in the Central African Republic, Andri Grote, in his article, basically declared that their driver is called Bienienu Nduvokama. I'm sorry, again, I'm butchering this. The center states that, at least that the driver exists in the database of French journalists who work there, where basically they're like, because the French obviously keep contacts in the database of everyone, of their own people, who work in the Central African Republic. So, on the 28th of July, this Nduvokama basically took the investigators to the main base of Russian instructors in the village of Berengo, where, by the way, previously there lived and, you know, was also buried there, the self-declared emperor of Central Africa, Jean Bedel Bokassa, who basically was running the country from 1966 to 1979, because, yeah, in 1980, he was put under trial, and he was, you know, accused of being a traitor and, you know, of cannibalism. This village, basically, is located about 60 kilometers from the capital of CAR, Bangui. And this base of Russian instructors, and again, everywhere in respectable media, these instructors are always in quotation marks. Yeah, this was created there with the permit of the United Nations. Technically, the military forces of the Russian Federation are supposed to teach locals how to properly use weaponry and, you know, some battalion-level tactics of the governmental forces who are now fighting against this Selenko separatist group. Instructors basically had set up, just right next to Bokassa's grave, a bunch of their tents. And, on the Facebook page of the Central African Republic, by the way, the president of the Central African Republic is called Fosten Arkanja Tuadera, there have been some photos on melee fighting, which these guys are supposed to train also, so at least, you know, they're maybe doing something. And also, you know, on his Facebook page, you'll find photographs of a president's advisor in security details, Valery Zakharov. Yeah, nice advisor, this Mr. Zakharov, obviously such a Central African French name. First off, these guys arrived there in 2014, but we found out that these guys were actually from this Wagner Corporation in the 15th of January this year, 2018, when the British analytical agency Stratfor basically first announced, with obviously full links to their sources, that these civil instructors, instructors sent from Russia are actually from Wagner. Last time Berengo also showed up in the news in general, according to the local journalists, in the end of July, when the wife of this ex-emperor Bokassa actually had written to President Tuadera with the demand to kind of remove the instructors from the village where her husband has been buried. This nice cannibal person, amazing. Rastorguyev, Jamal, and Radchenko, again, were not allowed in Berengo because they were asked there before entering a permit from the Ministry of Defense of CAR. At that point, when they couldn't enter Berengo, then journalists basically moved to other regions of the Republic, which has been reported in the United Nations report from the 23rd of July about where the Russian instructors have been placed. According to the United Nations data, one of the places where these Russian instructors are, you know, dislocated is the town of Sibiu, which is the center of the prefecture of Kemo. This small town is basically on the crossroads of two roads. One drives through Dekao to the north, where the Muslim separatists are located in Kaga Bandoro, and other to the east to the town of Bambari. In the United Nations report, it is told that in Sibiu are under arms Russian instructors, but in Bambari they are often seen in the columns of the governmental forces. Without this support from the governmental forces, Russian columns cannot basically drive through the territories, you know, occupied by these Muslim separatists. In the 10th of June, according to the United Nations again, instructors also took part in a military conflict with these soldiers from the group called Union for Peace in Central Africa. The center reports that from Sibiu, the journalists were supposed to go to Bambari. There, they were supposed to meet Martin, this mysterious Martin, from the mission of the United Nations. Quote, "He was supposed to give us information about the situation with the Russian military instructors and help us with filming the kind of gold mines in Ndassima." Now the gold mines in Ndassima. This is the fun part where you have to start digging deeper. Some analysis will follow later on, but essentially Ndassima, that's a small place about 50 kilometers north from Bambari, where basically the largest gold reserves in the country are found there. In 2010, before the beginning in the civil war in Central African Republic, a Canadian company, Axemen, bought the rights to work there and to kind of mine gold for 25 years. In 2013, the Muslim separatists who are basically in opposition to more kind of Christian, still very authoritarian, powers in the Central African Republic, from this coalition, Seleka, basically took control over this region. but Axemen basically evacuated everyone and stopped to work there. In 2014, Reuters, that news agency, wrote that these separatists, using very basic tools and methods, get approximately 15 kilograms of gold per month there. 15 kilograms per month, using the most basic techniques ever. According to the data of the United Nations control over Ndassima, up to this point still is being held by Muslim units, this very old Alliance for Peace in Central Africa, and National Front of Resurrection of Central African Republic. Yeah, because, you know, Seleka, this main group, has broken about in these parts. But United Nations does not mention any Russians participating in this work. I'll get to this, because here is what I'm basically translating you from all of my Russian sources, you know, smack together. And I'll get to what Seleka is later on, too, but this is not important. Basically, they are the guys who supported the previous president of the Central African Republic, and the war has been going on there for a while. But remember this, that there is nothing about this in the United Nations report. First, I want to deal with the hard data, and then analysis will follow. So don't worry about that, because this gold mine, I suppose that's the most important thing in this whole story.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Axemen, by the way, up until the very latest period of time, up until right now, they were planning to return to the, you know, the place where they are qualified and legally allowed to get gold. In the December of 2017, in the report for the investors, Axemen wrote that their representative had met with the vice mayor of Bambari to, quote, discuss the situation and express the desires of the company to return to the mines. I'm basically about some sort of like future meetings or something. No reports. This is the last one. However, in the October 2017, Sergei Lavrov, which is a chief of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia, he met in Sochi with Mr. Tuader, the president of Central African Republic. And partially, according to official reports, they discussed immense potential in the partnership in the sphere of acquiring and mining, you know, natural resources. And there, in Central African Republic, at this point, two Russian companies showed up. One of them was kind of a mountain mining group called Lobaye Invest, and a security company called Seva Security Service. By this point, French media stated in their own reports that these both groups are tied with our nice, cool friend Yevgeny Prigozhin. Just to remind you, listen to my PVC Wagner episode. There's all about Mr. Prigozhin. Yeah, he also owns the Wagner thing. So, in the 18th of July this year, a French site, AfricaIntelligence.com, that's an investigative journalist site, wrote that one of the main goals of these Russian companies is this Ndassim, where our journalists were supposed to go. And this is where the fun begins. In the 30th of July, Rastorguyev, Radchenko, Jamal, and their driver arrived in Sibiu. Anastasia Groshkova, who is an assistant to the editor of the center, told BBC that by this point, journalists started to have doubts about the trustworthiness of their driver. The thing is that day before, in the 29th of July, the car was stopped by two local cops, and where the journalists were driving at that point in the 29th is not kind of clear. But yeah, these two cops basically asked for a bribe. And, you know, their demands were translated by the driver, because Jamal spoke Arabic and a bit of English. Rastorguyev only spoke Russian. And well, Jamal also spoke Russian. He's a Russian citizen from the Caucasus. And Rodchenko, he also spoke a bit of English and Russian, but none of them spoke French or the local Songu language. I guess I hope I pronounced it correctly. But basically, Arabic is what some of these Muslim separatist groups also spoke. So apparently, Jamal had contacted them, but yeah, none of them spoke French or local languages. According to Gorshkoya, the chief editor, Konyakhin of the center, was basically the chief editor was sure that these corrupt cops were sent to our journalists here specifically by this driver Nduvokama. But the journalists themselves were doubting that at this point and decided, you know, not to cut their ties with the driver. Apparently, they were asked to pay for illegal filming, and, you know, they had to pay up to $200 in cash or something. You know, it's fairly obvious. But this role of the driver is not clear, exactly. Martin seems a much shadier figure. As later was reported by the Ministry of Communications of the CAR in this post, you know, security posts, because they're all over the roads. On this security post to Sibiu, the local warriors, the local soldiers, advised journalists not to drive any further because it was already dark. And yeah, sun sets down in the Central African Republic, it set down on the 30th of July at about 6 a.m. But they did not agree to this recommendation. This is according to the official ministry. Again, going into my analysis later on. Out of this town, the car didn't drive to the east, to the side of Bambari and to the gold mines, but they drove to the north, through a forested road to Dekoa. And nobody understands in the center that sent them, that worked with them, or the Khodorkovsky, why they did this. The reasons why they moved away from their planned route are completely not known, because kind of contacts with at this point with these three journalists they were impossible, because outside of the cities in the Central African Republic there's like no cell phone coverage, no nothing. The road, by the way, which they took with the Russian journalists, it was quite well described by the kind of independent journalist and author Philip Kleinfeld. I'm sorry, I'm translating from Russian here, it's just too much, and I need to get this out so fast that I hadn't had time to translate everything, all of my materials, from Russian to English in written form, so this is translating as I go, because there's just too much, but this is too urgent, really, so please forgive me that. In 2014-2015, the peacekeepers of the United Nations from Burundi and Gabon, these guys, these peacekeepers, forced the local women to have sex with them. And apparently, the road of Sibiu-Dekoa, even though it has asphalt on it, it has a hard cover, basically, this is one of the less safest roads in the Central African Republic. That's how Kleinfeld describes this. 70 kilometers of beaten asphalt almost completely drives through a tropical forest, and driving through there are only like a couple of dozens of some tiny villages there. And my next part of this comes from Medusa, which are awesome, my awesome nice Russian journalist friends from Riga. Medusa managed to speak with some people who actually had driven this road before. So, Medusa spoke with two people who were moving through this road in April and May through this year. with the journalist Philip Kleinfeld, obviously, and the kind of elder science worker in the Human Rights Watch, Louis Mage. Both told Medusa that during the day, the road to Dekoa is somewhat safe. There are some security posts there, but they are being controlled by the governmental forces, but not these Muslim soldiers. Both stated that these rebels from Seleka, which has fallen apart by now, are not there up until the town of Kara Bandoro, which is found much more north than Dekoa. According to Mage, during the night, however, this trip because by the road of Sibiu Dekoa is much more dangerous, but still, the murder of the three journalists seems strange, quote-unquote, for him. Quote, myself, I wouldn't drive there in the night, like, at all. You can meet wild animals, or suddenly just accidentally hit someone just walking across the road. Besides that, there are highwaymen on the road, but they usually don't kill anyone. That's how Mage declared this. Neither Mage nor Kleinfeld couldn't understand why journalists moved away from their planned trip and didn't just drive straight to Bambari. Kleinfeld states that the road to Bambari is, like, multiple times less dangerous. Mage doesn't consider it to be extremely dangerous, but adds that the road coverage there is even worse than to the road leading north. And, as stated by the government of CAR, in July, the state delegation drove almost to Bambari to check how the reconstructions of the road are going there. And apparently the local clerks, were satisfied about this. By now there are certain versions about how exactly they were killed. And it's still, there's less understanding about what exactly happened. But that's nothing when you compare it to why. But about how? Well, as their driver, who survived, by the way, which is extra suspicious, and still, how this Nduvokama survived, after about 33 kilometers of the road, they were stopped by 10 armed men from an ambush and opened fire. He managed to somehow hide and survive. In the 31st of July, the mayor of Sibiu, one Andri Depele, announced that basically the journalists were ambushed at about 22 or 10 p.m. Their car was apparently stopped, and they were shot at from the surrounding tropical bushes around the road. And the three journalists apparently died instantly. Some informational agencies, like AFP, announced on the 31st of July that the Russians first were stopped on one of these block posts, as they're called in Russian, but after that killed. The French newspaper Le Monde, on the 1st of August, stated that one of the members of the group were killed instantly, but the two of them were killed a bit later on. And on the 1st of August, the newspaper Palame Centrafrique, together with announcements with their own, like, resources there, wrote that journalists were at first dragged out of the cars, and they were kidnapped. After that, they were interrogated, and then they were killed. These guys were the first ones to publish a photograph of the bodies of Jamal and Rastorguyev with bodily wounds from the bullets. Without any sources, however, this newspaper kind of accused these Selek guys in the murder. In the 2nd of August, the press secretary of the government of Central African Republic, Ange Maxim Kazagi, told RBK, which is Russian committee about investigation, that in the night on the road to Dekoa, the journalists were stopped by a group of about 10 people in turbans, which is sort of somehow important because, and apparently these guys who stopped them were not locals. These guys apparently were speaking in Arabic and demanded to give and turn over the car to them. One of the journalists started to basically resist. The attackers opened fire, killing that one on the spot, and the two others died from their wounds. Kazagi added that during the nights, this road is full with bandits, robbers, and armed dangerous elements. During the same day, the Ministry of the Information, of CAR, made it more clear that basically these guys who attacked them definitely were not speaking neither in French or Sango, which are two of the state languages in Central African Republic. The local site, Korbiao News CA, giving their source as the driver, not stating from where the driver's words came from or his message came from, basically stated that the journalists apparently understood the language of the attackers. And again, this is important because Jamal, he spoke Arabic and Russian and English. Those were the three languages that the journalists who were driving there could understand. Even though they probably should have taken someone who knows French with them, but again, I'll get to that when we get to the analysis part. And right now we have no idea where is their surviving driver, if even he has managed to survive by this point. Because in the morning of the August the 3rd, the local journalist Andriy Grote stated that this driver is under guard in the capital of Central African Republic, Bangui, in basically their national gendarmerie. Parlam Centrafrique, this newspaper, states that this driver basically is now healing himself after being wounded in a hospital in an unknown city. They also promise to post more details from him when he finally gets better. And the final news, which basically just popped up this morning before recording, in the morning of the 4th of August, the bodies of the journalists were basically moved from Bangui to Paris. And the kind of temporary ambassador of Russia to CAR, Viktor Tomakov, stated that they were going to be transferred to Moscow on the 5th of August during the night when all the ceremonies will be held. These are all the facts that we know so far, gathered from multiple sources and slapped together. But now, there is much more, because these are the facts about the journalists, but not about the facts why we're there, because this is where Kristaps puts on stuff that he has gathered from YouTube and from other commentaries on the subject, and this is where we get a bit more depressed, I suppose, than we're used to. Because, again, so much information, there just needs to be some clarity here. First things first, however, before we begin, I gathered all of this from a million sources. I've been spending my Friday night just dragging through every possible thing ever about this whole situation, and I basically skipped all over the part about who are the Seleka and why the civil war is going on, because that's not as important, except some commentary which will involve the Russian government's involvement there. But this has been a tough night, and I haven't really slept, to be honest, but the fact remains that the Russian news, the Russian mainstream media, when they reported on this, because they were the first guys I watched, what got my attention was that after the deaths of my colleagues there, the mainstream Russian media, not one of them, not RTV1, not the second channel, not the NTV, nobody. Nobody in the mainstream media even mentioned that they were there to investigate the Wagner thing, which was kind of clear by their investors, by their program, by everything, and Maria Zakharova, who's often responsible, a politician who's responsible for all the situation, she basically called the center's journalists, their main editor, to be interrogated. And she stated publicly some sort of all crazy things about how this must have been an instant robbery and how, like, totally it must be crazy, crazy separatists. But we'll get all this the next part. The thing is that when honest, really good journalists get killed like this, that when you know why they were there and you have documentation that proves it, first question pops up. Well, why didn't they speak about it? Why didn't they say that they were investigating this Wagner thing at all? That got me a bit mad. So that's when I decided to dig deeper using these facts as basis. So this is from the news. So far, everything that I've told you was from sources with documentation and everything. Everything that I'm about to tell you in the next part, like in the analysis part, it comes from unconfirmed things. Those are all speculations, theories, and sources who do not reveal their own source of information. That comes from anonymous sources on YouTube by people who want to hide their names. And they represent various opinions. It's not simple as that, but these were all the facts. When it comes to analysis, well, as usual, I just, you know, I turn on my machine and call some people. Then I ask their opinion. This is what I did. So, take it with a grain of salt, because obviously I cannot guarantee the following to be exactly 100% true. But I truly did my best to do some actual investigations here. So if anyone, you know, asks for the source for my analysis and my thoughts on the whole thing, just give them the Eastern Border. Because sometimes you have to be the primary source for yourself, I suppose. So, to actually understand what happened, first off, and this comes from Alexander Sotnik, which I probably have spoken about in my opposition journalist episode, which is where I released my kind of sources for what's going on. First, about the gold. About the gold in Prigozhin. As you've heard before, in the February massacre, or more, should I better say, liquidation of PVC Wagner in Syria, Prigozhin was basically using these men who had nothing better to do because the economy of Russia is crashing down, so they're joining these mercenary groups. He's using them to gather resources for himself, and this gold mine stuff is very, very kind of lucrative. According to what my sources say, and Alexander Sotnik is one of them, Stepan Demura is other one, because, you know, I can't confirm where they get their stuff, but I can at least give you where I get my stuff. Technically, in Russia, everyone's expecting hyperinflation. And we know this because apparently there has been a deal made by the Central African Republic's government with the Russian government that involves minting platinum investment coins for the Central African Republic. The problem is they're going to be minted in Russia using Russian platinum. And then they'll be traded for the gold in Central African Republic. And you might ask yourself, why not bother doing this kind of, you know, with money or transactions? But this is the thing. Gold is really hard to trace. And when the people who run the economy of a whole country are stockpiling on gold, like Putin's personal friends are trying to stockpile as much gold as they can, then that means they know something. Other fact that we know, surely, this comes from Tsargrad TV, from Dmitry Pronko, is the fact that in July, and this is a fact, that in July, the Russian businesses have to pay their taxes. And they have to pay their taxes in rubles. And it's like, I guess it's April in America, but it's July in Russia. So, this year there has been a record amount of dollar sales in the market. Because all the export companies, they have their deals in dollars. They transfer, like, Russia mostly works in dollars when they export stuff. They work with yuan, with Chinese, but with the rest of the world, they mostly work in dollars. So these exporting companies like Gazprom, Rosneft, and other ones, essentially when they sell oil or gas, they get paid in dollars, but they have to pay their taxes in rubles. So at one point during July, they have to go to the central banks or to the free market and sell their dollars for rubles. The course of, like, exchange rate for ruble right now, ruble to dollar, is 63.79 rubles per dollar. The problem is it's kept artificially low by the Central Bank of Russia and by the high oil prices because ruble is tied to the Russian oil companies. But literally, there was a record low sales, like when these companies in July had to sell off their dollars to get rubles to pay taxes. The amount of dollars that they sold, when comparing it to the last year, fell by more than 200%. Like, it was 223% or something. It was, like, less than a half of what was last year. Like, a terrible loss. Which means that they're keeping up with the dollars. They're just not selling them, and that they're basically... These Russian companies, these big guys who manipulate with the whole market stuff, they are, instead of selling their dollar reserves to get to pay their taxes, they are instead borrowing money from the banks in rubles and holding on to their dollars. Those guys from their companies are also personal friends of Putin. And this comes from Sotnik himself, and I have no other way to confirm this, but last year they launched two new banknotes in Russia, one for 200 rubles, one for 2,000 rubles. This year they have already kind of confirmed the design for a 10,000 ruble banknote, for a 50,000 ruble banknote, and like for these huge banknotes, and they will be taking out the smaller coins from circulation, so there will be no 1 or 2 ruble coins anymore, and they're getting rid of the 5 and 10 ruble banknotes because you can't buy anything for them anyways. Which, basically, you know, if you put 2 and 2 together, it looks like they are preparing for a situation where ruble is going to go through a hyperinflation, and where just keeping up to your foreign currency reserves and liquid gold, because they're trading stuff away, obviously, will keep you afloat, and you'll just be able to just steal a lot of money again from some population or another. And let me remind you, which I have spoken about before in my previous current events episode, that as the football championship happened in Russia, the World Cup, that they increased the age of the pensions, which they did very rapidly. In other countries, essentially, if you're 55 and you're supposed to go into pension when you're 60, then, you know, you still get to go to pension when you're 60. The process, like in Estonia, is spread over the period of 20 years. In Russia, it's going to happen in 5. So, one other thing that's going to happen in Russia is that we over here in Eastern Europe, as you've heard from my historical shows a lot, we, like, everyone has a country at home, and everyone grows their own food. And, like, if you have a cow that gives out milk, like, 1 or 2 cows or something, you're just a private guy owning 2 cows, that's not considered a form of business, really. You can't tax that. It's just that you can't drink all the milk. If your cow produces 35 liters of milk per day, then you are free to just go to the market and sell the rest off. And that wasn't considered a business in Russia, so it wasn't taxed. That wasn't considered like a small business or something. Right now, they are intending to tax all these like individual farmers, like people with a cow, people with 10 chickens or something living in the countryside, in the vast, vast countryside, let me remind you, of Russia. See, due to the fact that Russia's agricultural sector and the large farms has gone to shit lately, and I would have said gone downhill, but then I thought about it, understood that a gone to shit is more precise term here, so this is not swearing for nothing, this is swearing with a meaning. You have to understand that 80% of all the Russian meat is imported. Secondly, of the meat that they produce, 80% again, about 80%, like 79.5 or something, just rounding stuff up. It's produced by these kind of small farmer guys who just go to central farmers markets and sell this stuff. Now they're going to get taxed. And while all of this is happening, businesses are closing down, they're increasing their prices, and the inflation rates, well, if Mr. Sotnik is correct, is about to explode. This is about the gold, why the gold should be necessary to the Russian government. Second part, and I'm going to tie this all together, don't worry. Second part is that the Russian government instantly came about with the answer that, oh, it must have been a robbery. Which is one of the theories why the journalists were killed, but if you think about it, robbing a journalist is very stupid, really. Like, killing a journalist is dumb. Because, like, Alexander Nevzorov, one of my more respected Russian journalists, and, like, one of the most respected Russian journalists and analysts in general, stated on his show, was that you don't kill journalists at random. Just don't, especially in such crime-ridden areas. Sure, the problems there are solved quickly and easily with a round from Kalashnikov, which is his words again, but those guys who work there as highwaymen, for example, they know that it's much, much more profitable to throw journalists into some dark pit and keep them alive, and, you know, to ask the European guys and the Western guys in general, you know, they have all these foundations behind them, and they know that we actually value life, because over here it's much more expensive than there, where life is cheap, and life is cheap for everyone, and life is often short and miserable, especially when a country is driven into a civil war. So they know this, because there haven't been that many murders of journalists in Central African Republic. Instead, in fact, I was hard-pressed to find even a single one before. So the fact that it would be a robbery, well, yeah, sure. They had about $8,000 in cash with them and somewhat expensive filming equipment, but you have to take into account that if they were financed by Khodorkovsky, which is a well-known Russian oligarch, and then they could have just gotten so much more money from not killing these people, from, like, keeping a ransom. Because, hey, what are $10,000 for a major media company? What are $10,000 for people whom you've sent away? I'm pretty sure that that Khodorkovsky and the center were ready to pay these amounts, because for your everyday citizen, that's okay. But if you're sending, like, really famous, and again, I said really, that's my code name, I suppose, but if you send extremely professional, well-equipped journalists with more than 25 years of experience in being war correspondents, they are valuable, and you know that they're going to get good material out of there. And even though that material probably would be shown mostly to the West and wouldn't make an impact in Russia, but still, you keep your investment safe. Because $10,000 to save up real professionals is really cheap, if you think about it. It's just, you know, their material will just earn you back that and more. And the guys who do these kidnappings, they also do this, because if these guys were some small-time, first-time journalists, that would be a different story. It wouldn't have reached the level of outrage it has in these parts. But for Eastern Europe, those guys were, like, the most massive journalistic celebrities ever. If you have a chance of kidnapping them, then you know you're going to get all the dosh ever. What gives me some suspicion is that they were killed by men in turbans who apparently spoke neither of the official languages, didn't speak the local languages there, but they did spoke a language that journalists understood. Of course, this is all like speculation, because we don't have surefire facts, and what do I know? I live in Latvia instead of Central African Republic, obviously. But yeah, if you think about this, then it just the theory of robbery that is so promoted by the Russian media just makes no sense. Because the very fact that we have so little information here, and by the way, Khodorkovsky now organizes an independent journalistic investigation en masse to go there and investigate the whole thing, so he had the money to save them, because he's now organizing this investigation, and there will be people driving the Central African Republic. That alone proves that, hey, there's something happened there. But if you think about it from the perspective of some cui bono thing, like Cicero would state, then you understand that, hey, any real investigation, because, you know, the central attorney offices of Russia are so corrupt that literally nobody expects them to do anything, but any real investigation would be just impossible to create in this war-torn country, in the middle of nowhere. And if you have some crazy-ass plans that you don't want to reveal to the public, and if you have a personal hatred towards these professional journalists, then hey, this is the ideal opportunity to which to kill them. And of course, there's the counter-argument that this message would have never been heard and stuff like that, but if you think about it, this is the place of the perfect murder, which is what angers me the most. Secondly, about this whole situation, the idea that they just moved away from, that they had, like, no guards, that they moved away from their position, that they never met this Martin guy, that they trusted this. I mean, those guys were professionals with 25 years of experience in surviving even getting shot in Libya. So they don't make rookie mistakes. You don't make rookie mistakes when you become a professional. And that just means that they were not just, they weren't tricked. They were worked with professionally. Someone led them, and the fact that Jamal himself reported even being followed in Russia kind of gives me the impression that he was very professionally led to this, that he was worked with in the language of the special services. And yeah, again, conspirology, but still, hey, I don't have any concrete evidence, I just have this whole circumstance which just blatantly points about this. And the Russian investigators, the official investigators, are just utterly ignoring this obvious thing that, hey, Pevets and Wagner might have just killed them, which is the most obvious explanation, and they're not even mentioning the Pevets and Wagner anywhere, which just adds extra suspicion. And sure, it might have been kind of some random locals, but apparently it wasn't random locals. that causes even more confusion, because it weren't any local Muslim separatist guys, at least according to the Central African Republic. They might have been just hired by them, they might have been just tricked by them, forced by them into submission, and the fact that we don't even know about a driver currently also is a bit crazy. So if you think about it, then, well, I personally believe that, yes, it was the Wagner guys who killed them. And the answer there's this counter-argument, which is like, because I listened to some Russian opposition news sites like Tsargrad and everywhere else, who are basically guys who yell at the Russian government, but they never say anything bad about Putin, because they consider Russian government to be, like, very liberal and controlled by American special forces, right? Stuff like that. But they state that the argument is that it couldn't have been the Wagner guys, because this is too obvious, these guys were too famous, so it must have been the West to make Russia look bad again, just as the same with Skripal argument. But I have a counter-argument to this, because, you see, Wagner guys have less to do with the official army whatsoever, because this might show, and a lot of people state, that in Russia we are observing some sort of an internal conflict between these oligarch groups surrounding Putin and influencing him a lot. One of these groups is represented by this Prigozhin, who represents these mercenaries and this business interests. Another player in the whole game is Shoigu. Shoigu is the Minister of Defense of Russia, and he represents the army interests, because the army is pissed off that they can't do this by themselves and grab all the profits that way. And if you remember the February episode, and this is another argument often stated by the opposition media in Russia, is that the murder of the Wagner guys, which was basically, there's a theory now going on that it was all set up by the army, that is why they didn't have anti-air support or advanced technologies or whatever. It was a setup because Prigozhin wanted to grab the oil reserves in Syria, but the Russian army, which communicated with the Americans, they gave him false information, and they basically set up the deaths of their own, kind of, because it was from, basically, it was, imagine if Marines and the army would have hate each other so much that they actually actively would go out of their way to harm each other. Except this involves business interests too, you see. And it seems like the fact that all these Wagner guys were killed, that was like Shoigu doing his thing. But now this is some sort of a revenge from the Wagner guys themselves going back to kind of hide their interests to hurt Shoigu a bit. Because if you think about it, then the Russians can't actually do a real investigation on this, and everything's just muddled in the clear. So, the Prigozhin with his Wagner guys would like to have some bad PR, because he's way less known in the West and in the public than Shoigu, the Minister of Defense of Russia. So that would just be bad PR for Shoigu. In the end, well, it all boils down to the fact that they were killed, and I do not believe that the fact that they did some unprofessional things and were just getting in the random ambush, those guys survived in a crazier war zone than Central Africa. Those guys were professionals. The idea that they made silly rookie mistakes is the most dumbest idea ever. The idea that this wasn't premeditated somehow is the dumbest idea ever. The fact that this Martin guy, that they trusted him completely, why did they do that? What? There must be something deeper behind this. Now, I do not know this. What I do know for sure is that three of my colleagues were killed. And the obvious evidence, once again, and even though it's circumstantial, points to our nice friends in the Russian government. Points to the fact that they just found a nice way how to dispose of uncomfortable people. And although this is a public scandal, it's not very widely represented in the West, because you guys might not know about these three guys, but we do, and they're taken very seriously in Russia. But the fact that three journalists are dead because they were loyal to their work and they did their journalistic duty, that's scary and sad. And the fact that there's going to be multiple independent investigations, at least that's good. Because I think this event does not get the required attention that it should. Here we can see that the Russian government's changing. They're changing in multiple ways. But if my sources are true, this is the beginning of the split of power and kind of the precursor to massive hyperinflation. Like Alexander Benediktov, the chief editor of Echo Moskvy, says, "Будем наблюдать." We will watch over this. I've tried my best to give you the description of what happened, and my, well, although limited, analysis of why it did. Sure, I have my own biases, and it might have well be just random, but when the fact that it might be just random robbery sounds less reasonable and has way less evidence supporting it, then you have to think about yourself, especially. I've been receiving death threats too, but hey, at least I live in a NATO country. This'll be it for this episode, and if something pops up again, I'll inform you about this, probably mention it in the future episodes as usual. But yeah, in memoriam, comrades. You did your job. And you have to give some respect to those guys. До свидания, товарищ.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Border. If you have any comments or specific details you'd like to know, you're welcome to leave it in the comment section on our site, theeasternborder.lv, and we'll rummage even to the western border to find you an answer. Like this podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or on our RSS feed. Happiness is mandatory. Good reviews and donations feed the farmers of our kolkhoz in the great motherland. The Eastern Border salutes you. This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org for more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.